It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. PFAS chemicals have been a growing concern in Wisconsin, with high levels found in groundwater and drinking water in many communities.
New research is tackling another question: are these forever chemicals showing up in people? A new study looked at the levels of PFAS in the blood of over 600 adults in Wisconsin.
These substances have been linked to cancer, changes in metabolism, and lower birth weight, among other complications.
The researchers were unable to make a direct cause and effect relationships, but the study did find out who is more likely to have higher PFAS levels, and that two foods in particular are linked to higher levels of the chemicals in a person's blood.
Amy Schultz is a researcher and co-author for that study, recently published in the Journal of Environmental Research. She's an epidemiology senior data scientist with the Real World Evidence to Advance Community Health, or REACH, program at UW's School of Medicine and Public Health. Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yes, happy to be here.
First of all, can you talk about the importance of trying to figure out, okay, is this PFAS that we know is in water in many places in Wisconsin is ending up in us?
Yeah, well, it's important for us to understand a baseline of prevalence of PFAS exposure. You know, how many people have detectable levels? What's the dose of exposure? How high are those levels? It enables us to continue to do research. You know, it lets us know, are there subpopulations that may be more exposed that we previously were unaware of outside of known contamination sites or areas of concern? And then it allows us to compare prevalence of PFAS exposure in a general Wisconsin adult sample to a national population. You know, are Wisconsinites more or less exposed to PFAS?
We're going to look at those results and see, you know, who seemed to have more PFAS in their blood, what things might be linked at it. Before we do that, I want to put a little asterisk on it, Amy. If I'm reading your research right, we're not seeing something where people should be alarmed about it, where if they say, oh, I eat that or I'm in that category, I should be really worried. Do I have that about right?
That's correct. This is an initial preliminary study that we use existing data. Mm-hmm. So it was an existing cohort of Wisconsin adults. They'd already provided survey data and interview data on behaviors, dietary information, demographics, and stored serum samples, blood samples, for research such as this one. But because the data we use was not specifically asked in such a way to get at all potential sources of PFAS, mm-hmm. there's, you know, potential associations we weren't able to uncover, and more research is needed to really understand the associations we did find.
Okay.
It's also important to note that this was just one point in time that we looked at PFAS exposure in. Exposures change over the course of time, depending on, you know, what products and occupations people have, for instance.
With those disclaimers out of the way, what kind of things stood out to you when you compared PFAS levels in the blood of people from, as you said, different demographic groups, people who lived and ate differently?
Yeah, so in our study sample, we looked at microwave popcorn consumption frequency, dental floss use, eating locally caught fish from inland water bodies, Great Lakes area, meat consumption, vegetable intake. We also looked at whether you get drinking water from a private well versus a municipality, fast food consumption. So we looked at a variety of factors that we had information on, and we wanted to see within our study sample, how did those that have higher levels of PFAS compared to those that had lower levels. And what we found was older age males, non-Hispanic white adults, those from higher household income, and those who eat locally caught fish were more likely to have higher serum PFAS within our study sample.
So let's look at the locally caught fish. Fish are in water. Makes sense. That's where we find a lot of PFAS. When we worry about things like mercury contamination, we might end up saying, hey, maybe we shouldn't be eating these fish. Again, if I'm reading your report right, we're not there at this point. There's some higher blood level of PFAS in people eating that locally caught fish. I'm not alarmed about eating that walleye at this point?
No, you should not be alarmed for several reasons. One is the information we had on eating locally caught fish wasn't very detailed. So we weren't able to look at how many locally caught fish you eat per year and if that's related to increased dose of PFAS exposure. We didn't look at type of fish or specific water bodies or waterways. Also, I should note that, as I said earlier, it's very possible those in our study sample that eat locally caught fish are also more likely to be exposed to PFAS via another source that we weren't able to look at. For example, they may be more likely to also eat store-bought, commercially bought fish, and maybe they're getting PFAS from that source, and that's explaining the association we're seeing. I'm not saying that's true, but we just don't know. So we would need to do a follow-up study to really understand the underlying factors with these associations. Another important point is the difference in overall PFAS we found among those who eat locally caught fish and those who don't may not be clinically meaningful, meaning having a PFOS level of 5.6 parts per billion on average compared to 4.2 might not mean that you have any increased risk of an adverse health effect. So that requires additional research as well. We just don't know at this time.
Talking to Amy Schultz, epidemiologist with UW-Madison's School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at one study that tried to get at the question, is PFAS in Wisconsin water ending up in Wisconsin people? And Amy, a lot of what we're saying here points toward the challenges of studying PFAS in our bloodstreams. This is kind of an opportunistic study. This is blood that had been sampled for something else. You went back and looked at it. With what you have in hand now, what would you want to see? What would be your ideal design for more studies that could drill deeper into these questions?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there are several ideal next steps. One would be to dive into the trends seen in this study by gathering more specific and detailed sources of exposure information. So actually measuring PFAS in drinking water from these participants, more detailed dietary items, occupational exposure, consumer products. We didn't ask about nonstick cookware use or anything like that. Also, you know, some of these associations, there's clear underlying factors. So higher household income itself does not give you PFAS, right? So what are the underlying factors or behaviors among those in our study sample with higher incomes that might be driving that? Also, this is a first look and provides a baseline. So now we can track changes in PFAS in the population over time. So in the next 5, 10, 15 years, do we see decreases in PFAS among our study sample, in specifically after EPA has passed, the Environmental Protection Agency in 2024, has ruled to regulate PFAS in several ways, such as drinking water standards and manufacturing and cleanup sites. So that's another area. And then expanding the research to include more adults, so a larger study sample, more adults from diverse racial and ethnic communities in Wisconsin, and also to more geographical regions in the state. This was demographically representative largely, but there are geographical representation that could be expanded.
And that I wanted to mention geography. We know there are many places in Wisconsin downstream, their groundwater is downstream in effect from sources, airports, manufacturing facilities that put a lot of PFAS into the environment. Would you see use in more intensive study, more sample collection from people who live in areas where we know there's a lot of PFAS in the water?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot of utility in ensuring levels are going down as those sites are cleaned up, as they become regulated under the new EPA Superfund is now has two of the PFOS on the list to be under the cleanup site. So I think there will be a need for sampling in areas of known high exposure. The utility of doing a general sampling of PFOS prevalence among Wisconsin adults is also just to potentially understand if there are other subpopulations that stand out as having a higher exposure. We didn't see that, but we wanted to look, right? Because it's not just geography that's associated with PFAS exposure. It could be certain subpopulations or demographics that are exposed at higher levels because of different behaviors maybe cultural ones or consumer behaviors are different among different populations. And so we wanted to look at that as well.
Another challenge that pops in my head, and you've pointed toward this, I sometimes think PFAS is a thing. You've mentioned multiple times. There's hundreds of kinds of chemicals in these classes. Does that make it hard to test for all these different types of chemicals? Do we have tests that can test for lots of things, or are we doing them kind of one at a time?
That's a great question. PFAS exposure and the health effects associated with PFAS exposure are very difficult to specify for many reasons. There are actually at least 5,000 PFAS compounds, and they have varying toxicity levels, potentially varying health effects. And you're right in that most studies to date have focused on a limited number of better-known PFAS compounds. And that's largely because it's very expensive to test and to develop assays and tests to actually measure these in different analytes. So, I mean, like different mediums, so in blood versus in a food product or household dust or in water. So it's quite costly, and to get a large enough human study sample to donate blood, for instance, is also quite costly. There are potential findings from this study that are informative, in that one thing I haven't mentioned is that while over 96% of Wisconsin adults in our study sample had detectable levels for 6 PFAS compounds, for 8 of the PFAS compounds, no one in the study sample had detectable levels. And for an additional 9 PFAS compounds we looked at, fewer than 10 people had detectable levels. So there are PFAS compounds that either the half-life is short and they're not remaining in the body for very long, or exposure is very limited or very sparse, and it's not in a lot of consumer products.
And Amy, we'll leave it there. That's Amy Schultz, Epidemiology Senior Data Scientist with the Real World Evidence to Advance Community Health, or REACH program, at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, talking about efforts to track PFAS in our bloodstreams.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, the State Historical Society scoured the party conventions in Milwaukee and Chicago to document political history.
Rather than just displaying a button, if you can say who wore it, why they chose that one, why that item kind of symbolizes the convention to them, really makes that story richer.
Archiving political memorabilia, that's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Over the summer, producers from Wisconsin Today attended the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee and the Democratic National Convention in Chicago to document what it was like to be there for Wisconsin's party delegates. Here's a listen to some of those voices.
So, hey, listen, when you come to convention, it's a historic event, and we are in unprecedented times right now. This could have easily been a period of national mourning, and we're here celebrating Donald Trump and J.D. Vance, and you got to go big or go home.
I'm Mary Frances Forrester, a good Southern double name. I've been a delegate since 2008 to the continuous conventions, and part of that is the pride of wearing your patriotic colors. It's exciting to come here and see how people have planned, how they can wear red, white, and blue.
How does it feel to be here in Chicago?
Oh, it just feels really good. The energy, the vibe is just incredible. Yesterday when I got my luggage, Representative Maxine Waters was right there, and I'm like, I recognized her, and I was like so excited.
I'm Landyron Kern Jr.
And you are one of the youngest delegates. How does that feel?
It feels amazing. You know, to be such a momentous part of history, it's nothing like it. I mean, just walking in today, I can't believe what I'm seeing.
The Wisconsin Historical Society was also at the RNC and DNC, capturing history as it was unfolding by collecting buttons, posters, and other items displayed by delegates.
They added to the Historical Society's extensive collection of campaign memorabilia that helps to tell the story of our state's political history and our nation's politics.
Abby Norderhow is state archivist and director of acquisitions at the Wisconsin Historical Society. Abby, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you.
History, it is all around us. We're living it, you know, in the moment. How do you decide what is important for the Historical Society to collect and to preserve, to tell the story of Wisconsin?
So the Wisconsin Historical Society is always looking to document the lived experiences of the people in the state of Wisconsin. So we are looking for those moments, those stories, those events that impact our citizens and that will be critical to the future of the state.
I bet you have a lot of conversations with colleagues as to what those events are and then how, what to collect.
Yeah, we're really lucky. We have a really collaborative staff who is always so dedicated to history, dedicated to seeking out those really great stories. So lots of meetings and conversations to think about what we should be collecting, to make sure that we are documenting both sides of stories so that we're not skewing our collection one way or the other, and really making sure that we are finding both those big events that everybody sort of hears about and those smaller events that might be just in one community in the state.
Wisconsin has such a storied history in politics. How do you approach our political history?
The political history of Wisconsin is really fascinating. We, you know, we're the birthplace of the Republican Party. The progressive movement has its roots here. So there's just so many avenues of political history that one can look for in the state of Wisconsin. And as the political parties have sort of carved out different paths for themselves, we, again, really focus on ensuring that we are collecting in a nonpartisan way so that we are documenting as many political parties as we can, documenting as many campaigns as we can, and really trying to ensure that the issues are represented within our collection.
It sounds like you have to just follow the story, follow the events, and explore, you know, what there is.
Absolutely. And we, you know, we are the North American History Library for UW-Madison, and we have the second largest cereals collection in the country. So our cereals librarian does a wonderful job of looking for current emerging cereals and tracking down news stories and passing those along.
Wait, cereals, what does that mean exactly?
Cereals are like newspapers, magazines, those kind of publications that are issued on a somewhat regular schedule.
You went to the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee earlier this summer. Why is it important for the Historical Society to attend historic party events like that?
So the RNC in Milwaukee this summer was the first time that a major political party has had its convention in the state of Wisconsin. The 2020 Democratic Convention was supposed to be held in Milwaukee, but of course the COVID-19 pandemic derailed that, and that pandemic ended, excuse me, that convention ended up being held virtually. So this was the first opportunity that the Wisconsin Historical Society had to document a convention like that. And we're at just a really pivotal moment in history. This is going to be a close election. We know based on the previous election, this one will be very close. We know that it's a historic moment in our history. Even just, you know, the week after the RNC, the Democratic nominee changed, which made the RNC that much more historic.
Can we walk in your shoes at the RNC? What was a day like for Abby? Like, what did you do?
So the RNC was obviously the first political convention that I had been to, and I was lucky to attend with a colleague. So we were both there and were able to make collecting decisions collaboratively so that we were able to bounce ideas off one another and had two sets of eyes looking for things. So when we arrived at the RNC, you obviously have to go through a security perimeter so that you can be inside the gates there. And once we were there, we spent some time looking at Convention Fest, which had been put on by the RNC committee and had booths and displays from various organizations, both national and state. And then we were able to look for delegates and talk to them, explain what we were doing there, and ask them to keep their eyes open for things that they thought might be appropriate for the Historical Society.
I was wondering how much emotion and the observations you make once you're on the ground at a convention like that or an event like that, how people are interacting with the environment, with the buttons and the other other ephemera. Does that factor in with what you collect?
Absolutely. The environment was just charged with excitement. Everybody there was thrilled to be there, and everybody was excited to talk about what they were doing or what, you know, what state they were from, what they had brought to the convention with them. I personally noticed as the week went on, folks started wearing more buttons, more hats, more elaborate sort of clothing that supported their politics, their point of view. So that was just an interesting observation and one that photos of that event will reflect. So the Historical Society was lucky to contract with a photographer to take photos so that in addition to the paper documentation, we will also have photographic documentation of the event.
So once you have these items, how much in the moment are you able to collect about the item's origin story and by means of who brought that item, who made that item, where it came from, and you know, what it looks like? Can you talk a little bit about that orbit around the item itself?
Absolutely. So the story of the item is always what we're truly after. You know, the item is great and tells the story of itself, but being able to capture, you know, the person who used it, maybe the person who made it, any of those sorts of details that support it make that story so much more rich and allow visitors to the Historical Society to connect with items in a different way. So rather than just displaying a button, if you can say who wore it, why they chose that one, why that item kind of symbolizes the convention to them, really makes that story richer and makes history come alive to people.
It's these little threads and tidbits of one item at a time to build a bigger picture of what this history, you know, was like.
Absolutely. And so we wouldn't want, say, only buttons from an event. We would want to make sure we have a button and a T-shirt and a hat or at the Republican National Convention, there was a lot of attention on shoes. A lot of folks there had either gold shoes or flag shoes or sort of interesting footwear. So, you know, ideally we'll be able to at some point collect a pair of shoes from somebody who was there that tells that kind of aspect of things. So as you're there and as you're talking to folks and as you're observing, you kind of see those little nuggets that you know are an important part of the story.
You know, can you talk a little bit more about the buttons and the posters, these other items you collected, footwear, hopefully in the future? What did you take back to Wisconsin?
Sure.
Or Madison?
Yeah, at the RNC, we collected a couple different hats, both the Ren MAGA hat that you see a lot in on TV or in news conferences, because that's really emblematic of the party right now, and it's emblematic of the election and of Donald Trump as a candidate. So we collected one of those. We got a couple T-shirts that had his message on it, I believe, and buttons from a couple different conservative organizations that were displaying at the convention. One of my favorite items that we picked up were some conservation talking points. So things that were designed to give delegates or members of the party talking points about a particular issue.
Oh, that's really interesting, because that too tells the story of the, you know, what is valuable to a party and how they are communicating it.
Absolutely.
What about the ear patches? I know there are a lot of people who are talking about, you know, in solidarity of the assassination attempt on former President Trump. What did you see there?
So I was not in the convention hall at the RNC, so I didn't see anybody with an ear patch on myself. Obviously saw that in pictures. I am hoping that someone who was there in the future will donate an ear patch that they wore there.
We're talking about preserving political history in Wisconsin with Abby Norderhau, state archivist and director of acquisitions at the Wisconsin Historical Society. Let's turn our attention to the Democratic National Convention held in Chicago outside our state. You traveled there as well and collected items. Why do you think it was important to go to the DNC?
I think it was important for the Historical Society to be at the DNC for a couple different reasons. The first is that we were at the Republican National Convention, and it makes sense to collect that corollary convention so that we're able to look at both sides of the 2024 election. The other reason I think it's really important is just the proximity of our state to that convention. That I-94 corridor is a really important business corridor for both states, and just reflecting that relationship between Wisconsin and Illinois.
Did you take any different approaches to collecting items from the DNC, or was it very much a parallel type of procedure?
It was a mix of both. Based on my experience at the Republican National Convention, I really learned the importance of connecting with delegates. So I tried to reach out to a couple delegates before the DNC or early on in the DNC, because at the Republican National Convention, I observed that a lot of the signage handed out on the convention floor was handed out in the convention and remained with those delegates throughout. And recognizing how important that was, I wanted to make sure at the DNC we were able to capture that. So I took some lessons learned from the RNC to apply to the DNC and hopefully improve our collecting.
What kind of memorabilia stood out to you at the DNC?
So at the DNC, the signage I thought was really interesting. I appreciated after being at the RNC and watching the way the signage worked there, just the amount of signage and how prepared the committee, the DNC was to have the folks there have those signs to display and kind of the machinery, so to speak, that it took to get those out there. So I think the signage was really emblematic at both conventions. Also at the DNC, I was looking for things that that captured the moment and sort of the pop culture of the time that we were in. So one item that I ended up really liking that we collected was a Kamala t-shirt in the Barbie font that's also in her sorority colors. So I really liked that connected to her as a candidate. I liked that it connected to pop culture. And then, of course, because Barbie is from Willows, Wisconsin, it also kind of has a little kind of behind the scenes Wisconsin tie.
When you talk about the signage and it's the imagery and the impact, what stood out there? Was it fonts? Was it colors? Was it images itself?
I think it was, for me at both conventions, it's the font and then just the almost the overwhelming nature of it. The way that material was distributed was every delegate had one. So if you look at the pictures of the event, if you kind of have that not the view of the candidate, but if you have that wider view and you can see the candidate on the stage and then the folks in the audience, you can see just that visual blanket of signage, which I just thought was it's a great visual and it's just an interesting look at what messages the parties were both putting forward.
I think it's such a benefit because you have the photography, but you also have the tactile pieces of the things that you're photographing, the things that make up those photos that you can't touch, but you can see. And so that also, I think, brings us closer to the history.
Absolutely. We all see photos in our textbooks, but being able to come to the Wisconsin Historical Society, come to our new History Center, which will be opening in 2027, and look at the photo of the event as well as something that was actually at that event will hopefully really help people connect.
Let's go farther back in time, back in history. The Wisconsin Historical Society has this growing political history collection. What kind of items are in this collection and what significance do they have?
So our political history collection is vast, as we've been talking about here. We have things like a drinking glass that Teddy Roosevelt was using in Milwaukee, actually, in 1912 when there was an assassination attempt. So we have things like that. We have Vel Phillips, who was on the Milwaukee Common Council and was the first African-American and the first woman elected to the Milwaukee Common Council.
Yes, civil rights pioneer.
Absolutely. We have her roll-top desk. So, things like a very small drinking glass all the way to a large item of furniture.
And when you look through the gallery, you see some lighthearted buttons, you see bumper stickers from the presidential campaigns. And there's one that says "Leader for First Dog" from Bob Dole campaign. There's Cheeseheads for Clinton. Where and how do you see maybe humor and playfulness come out in campaign materials from the collection?
There's a lot of humor and playfulness in political campaign material. And I think what's really great about it is a lot of times it comes from the party themselves, right? They're trying to connect with people. They're trying to make their candidate seem human and seem like the kind of person that voters in the state will connect to. And using humor is obviously a wonderful way to do that. Political animals, political pets are super popular. We have other items that have political pets on them. That Cheeseheads for Clinton. At both the RNC and the DNC, delegates did wear cheeseheads. So obviously, we still connect to that. We still use that as a way to symbolize our state. So really looking for those items of connection and a way to keep things light.
Is there anything that's on your wish list that you don't have in the collection that you would really hope to acquire in the future?
That's such a great question. I think one thing that is really wonderful about working in an archives, working in a museum, is you almost don't know the world that's out there. You don't know what somebody might have and what that story might be. So I think we would always be looking to connect with somebody who was involved in a campaign. Maybe they were a volunteer. Maybe they ran from office themselves. Or look for somebody who was at a convention and brought something home because it really symbolized what was happening in that moment for them. Because we all connect to moments in history differently, and everybody brings their own perspective and their own spin on things. So any item that somebody has that has a story or has a personal connection to them about politics or about an event they experienced would be something we'd be looking for.
Abby, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Abby Norderhow, state archivist at the Wisconsin Historical Society and its director of acquisitions. We were talking about how the society attended this summer's national party conventions in Milwaukee and Chicago as part of its effort to collect items that reflect Wisconsin's place in political history.
Hey, have we been talking about you just now? If you have your own collection of political memorabilia, let us know about it. Maybe it's the classic campaign buttons or posters or stickers or other political novelty items of the past. We would love to hear about your collection, maybe even see it.
That's true. You can email us about your collections or keepsakes. You know what? Include a picture if you like. Go to email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or leave us a voicemail. You can text us at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
Head out of Wisconsin today, a group in Superior wants to create a state historical marker recognizing the crew of the Edmund Fitzgerald, which sunk in 1975.
Part of what has really made the Fitzgerald endure, what makes it captivating all this time later, is the lore, right? Is the unknown.
Meet the group Friends of the Fitz ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's been almost 50 years since the SS Edmund Fitzgerald sank in Lake Superior on its way to Detroit. All 29 crew members perished.
The ship stretched more than two football fields long. For almost two decades, it had carried taconite from Silver Bay, Minnesota, to steel mills in Detroit and Toledo.
The Fitzgerald's last port of call was Superior. It left that city with a load of taconite on November 9th, 1975. The tragedy of what happened to the ship lives on in the memory of people in the region.
Now, a group of residents called Friends of the Fitz is creating a historical marker for the ship and for its crew.
Jenny Van Sickle is a member of the Superior City Council, and Teddy Moronic is a retired librarian and local historian. Both are with Friends of the Fitz. Jenny, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much, Kate. We're really excited to be here.
And Teddy, welcome to you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Teddy, the Edmund Fitzgerald is one of the most famous shipwrecks in history. The Great Lakes Shipwreck Museum says its fame was surpassed only by the Titanic. Can you tell us about the history the ship has in Superior?
Well, this was the last port of call. Superior was the last port of call for the Edmund Fitzgerald. It left the docks in Superior's Eloise neighborhood on November 9th, and that was the last time any human being saw the Edmund Fitzgerald.
What aspect of the Fitzgerald's history really stands out to you, really hits you as something that this community in Superior really needs to reflect on?
Well, I think if you live in Superior or have lived in Superior, you realize the importance of Lake Superior, and you also, in a way, respect Lake Superior because she demands to be respected. And I think what the Fitzgerald brought to the forefront was that in sort of a fight between man and lake, the lake is probably always going to win, no matter the technology, no matter the intelligence of human beings. If the lake wants you, the lake's going to take you. And that's why you have to respect it and understand that we live by Lake Superior's rules.
Jenny, you've said that everybody in Superior has a connection to the Fitz. How do you see those connections resonating today, almost 50 years after this disaster?
There are so many people that have kept the Fitz's memory alive. And I think like anything, what people most often remember are the people and the crew and the mission that put them out in the gales of November. And, you know, Superior has been a shipping port since the creator, you know, made these waters available for trade for Ojibwe people. And, you know, this is a community that many, many families have served in the shipping industry and, you know, have a connection to the lake and the port.
Teddy, how did this come up? How did the idea arise to create a historical marker for the Edmund Fitzgerald?
Well, I had gone one day to the Richard Bong Veterans Museum in Superior, and Brianna Fine, who is the curator there, and I were talking, and we were talking about memorials, about, I was there doing research on Bong's plane and how it had come to Superior, or the plane that was similar to the one that he flew in the war had come to Superior. And we were just talking about his memorial out in Poplar and how people are remembered. And I think at the exact same moment, we both looked at each other and said, Edmund Fitzgerald, because I know for me, I had been wondering for a couple of years, like, why did we not have anything here in Superior about the Fitz? Like, why wasn't there a memorial to the men who served on the boat and to the boat itself when we were the last port of call for the Fitz? So we came up with the idea of maybe a Wisconsin State Historical Society marker might be appropriate for Superior. And we took it from there.
You took it from there. What were those initial next steps once you both said Edmund Fitzgerald at the same time?
Well, we hoped to find some people to help us, and we were lucky enough to find Jenny Van Sickle and then Kathy Loxo, who's owns a local theater group, and one of her goals is to write a play about the Fitz as a way to celebrate the anniversary next year, the 50th anniversary of the loss of the ship. So we thought the four of us should be able to get together and make this happen for Superior.
Jenny, where are you hoping to locate the historical marker?
We, you know, since May, and, you know, and I'll just say for my part, I'll do whatever Teddy Maronic tells me to do. So back in the spring, we met with the Parks and Rec Commission at the City of Superior to, you know, get their thoughts, get their ideas on location. Where were some places that the city parcels might be a good fit? And, you know, trying to also meet the requirements for the state's program. You know, you have to have certain accessibility, you know, access, things like that. So taking the state's requirements and the feedback from the Parks and Rec Commission, we started narrowing down different locations on the waterfront. So I represent the dock and the area, the geography in Superior where the Fitz, you know, made that final departure. And, you know, we looked in that area by the docks and some of the development in that area just makes it really difficult to meet all those requirements. So from there, we just kept looking at parcels. And finally, we settled, I think, on Barker's Island, which already really does a good job celebrating and recognizing the solemn and really powerful work of maritime in the city of Superior and, you know, the Twin Ports area. So, you know, we, I think, got the green light and we are moving forward with that application.
Teddy, take us to Barker's Island. What is the land like? What is the view like?
Well, the land is actually dredgings. It's a man-made island that was created in the late 1800s, but it has a fantastic view of the harbor. And the one thing I wanted with this marker is I wanted it to be near the last place where the Fitz was in Superior. That at the time seemed like an impossibility, but luckily the spot on Barker's Island, if you look, you can see the docks from where the Fitz left that day. So I'm really happy with that. And there's a lot going on at Barker's Island. The Meteor, which is the last whale back in above, we always have to clarify that by saying above water, whale back in existence, is on the National Register of Historic Places and sits at Barker's Island. So it already has sort of a tie to the maritime history of Superior and seems like the appropriate place for this marker.
We're talking about the Edmund Fitzgerald with Teddy Moronic there, retired librarian and historian, and Jenny Van Sickle, Superior City Council member. They're among the founders of the Friends of the Fitz, seeking to place a Wisconsin historical marker to remember the sinking of the crew of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Jenny, can you talk a little bit about where the project is at right now, where fundraising is at, and just a little bit of a vision there?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I would just add one piece that Barker's Island adds so much visibility for both tourists alike and local folks. When we were in our final, you know, scouting location, we had so many people walking by, walking their dogs, local people visiting and things like that. So I think it's a really good area to lift up that story. We have been really lucky to work with a local nonprofit, the Douglas County Historical Society, and they have agreed to help us collect and organize the donations because these markers are several thousand dollars. And, you know, if you want to customize them, there are different signs and things like that with limited characters. So it's several thousand dollars, but we are really confident that, you know, if folks who heard this story felt connected to it and felt compelled to, you know, donate $50 to commemorate 50 years and be a friend of the Fitz, this could be a really special place to visit and make new memories. So there's a Venmo, there's a website. I think we're putting some social media stuff together to, again, not only more broadly raise awareness, you know, shipwreck exploration has gotten really popular, but that also the people in Superior, you know, I think it'd be really easy just to, you know, go after a big sponsor, you know, big corporate. But we really want to focus on the community and really make this an effort by community for community. So any amount is absolutely welcome, and hoping to just retell that story and reinvigorate everybody's connection to the Fitz and to the crew, whether it's, you know, folks that stayed home at the time or kids that remember their dad sailing, you know, long and grueling hours.
Teddy, I'm thinking about the marker itself and thinking about a limited amount of space where every word counts in this history. How are you thinking about those words and what will be on this marker?
Well, I've already submitted my narrative. You have to do a pre-application, so I'm waiting to hear from the Wisconsin State Historical Society about that. But
They have specific guidelines. It's supposed to be an educational tool, the marker. So I kept my facts to the facts. You know, when, where, why, and how was the Edmund Fitzgerald in Superior, Wisconsin, and leaving from our port and never to come back. So it's an easy story to tell because Gordon Lightfoot has told it for many years.
Yeah.
And almost everything in his song is, you know, is pertinent to the narrative of the history of the Fitz.
I wonder about that. In 1976, Gordon Lightfoot's song, The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, it peaks at number 2 on the Billboard Hot 100. What do you think of cultural references to the shipwreck and the story of what happened and Gordon Lightfoot's song?
I think that if Gordon Lightfoot hadn't written that song, that certainly there would be people who remembered the Fitz, especially in this town. But I am amazed, and I have a story to tell you. I do mural tours for the Superior Public Library. The library has 35 murals that were created by local artist Carl Gobloy. And the last one in the series is of the Edmund Fitzgerald. I was doing a tour for a school group from Barron, Wisconsin, you know, which is a couple hours away from Superior. And these are middle school, high school kids. And I got to the Fitz mural, and I said, well, most of you aren't going to know about the Edmund Fitzgerald. To a person, every single one of them knew about it, and it was because of it, Gordon Lightfoot's song. Because I asked them, I said, how do you know about this? And they said, Gordon Lightfoot. So he has done a tremendous favor that this, you know, really, this boat and its crew is not going to be forgotten.
Jenny, with the 50th anniversary of the Fitzgerald sinking right around the corner next year, how would you like to see this occasion remembered in Superior?
I just really appreciate the historian in Teddy. And I think part of what has really made the Fitzgerald endure, what makes it captivating all this time later, is the lore. Right, is the unknown. And I would love to see Superior not only permanently recognize the crew and the mission of the Edmund Fitzgerald permanently with this marker, but I would love for us to really acknowledge that all year next year, you know, not just one day in November, but however the community engages, whether that's a book club or a play or, you know, seeing the mural tour, however you engage, you know, find a way to touch this history and, you know, permanently all year long. And then annually, I hope that we can, you know, build enough of that knowledge and awareness that the annual recognition endures.
Teddy and Jenny, thank you so much for sharing with us. Thank you for being here.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you, Kate.
Jenny Van Sickle is a member of the Superior City Council, and Teddy Moronic is a retired librarian and historian. They are leading an effort to establish a historical marker for the SS Edmund Fitzgerald in Superior. The group is called Friends of the Fitz.
That good ship and true was a bone to be chewed when the gales of November came early. The ship was the pride of the American side, coming back from some mill in Wisconsin.
Tomorrow on the show, we'll check out UW's Study Abroad program and meet Wisconsin students who have spent a semester on the other side of the planet.
And we want to hear from you. Did you ever do any kind of study abroad program, maybe in high school or college, or have you hosted international students in your home? Either way, let us know what that experience was like and what you learned from it.
Email us now at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text us at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.